With Tesla, your goal has been to make a better car. And you've done that with an electric vehicle that people covet, that has quite a cult following, that's upgradable. But you also want to achieve, and your turn of phrase is very nice, or try to achieve this platonic ideal of a car, right? To reach perfection. So what does the perfect car look like?
Well, I mean, I do use that phrase with our engineering design team, that aspirationally we're in pursuit of the platonic ideal of the perfect car.
Yeah.
And who knows what that looks like actually, but it's you want to try to make every element of the car as flawless as possible. And there will always be, you know, some degree of imperfection, but try to minimize that and create a car that is just delightful in every way. And I think if you do that, then the rest kind of takes care of itself.
That third failure in a row, did you think, I need to pack this in?
Never.
Why not?
I don't ever give up. I mean, I'd have to be dead or completely incapacitated.
8 weeks later, Musk bet the company on another flight.
We have liftoff.
And this time around, everything worked.
Perfect.
If that fourth launch hadn't worked, that would have been it. We would have not had the resources to mount a fifth.
Really liking what you do, whatever area that you get into, given that, you know, even if you're the best of the best, there's always a chance of failure. So I think it's important that you really like whatever you're doing. If you don't like it, life is too short. If you like what you're doing, you think about it even when you're not working. I mean, it's something that your mind is drawn to. And if you don't like it, you just really can't make it work, I think.
So many people tried to talk me out of starting a ride company. It was crazy. One good friend of mine collected a whole series of videos of rockets blowing up and made me watch those. He just didn't want me to lose all my money. We're doing these things that seem unlikely to succeed. And we've been fortunate, and at least thus far, they have succeeded. Now is the time to take risk. You don't have kids. As you get older, your obligations increase. And once you have a family, you start taking risk not just for yourself, but for your family as well. It gets much harder to do things that might not work out. So now is the time to do that. Before you have those obligations. So I would encourage you to take risks now. Do something bold. You won't regret it.
The failures are not the most terrible things. You have to learn from it and react to it.
Yeah, exactly. When you're building something new, there's going to be mistakes.
Yeah.
And it's important to recognize those mistakes, acknowledge them, and take corrective action.
Yeah.
And the success of a company is very much more about how quick are you to fix the mistakes, not will you make mistakes.
Or admit mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you see the difference between a startup that is successful and one that is not, and it's because the successful one, they both made mistakes, but the successful one recognized the mistakes, fixed them very quickly, and the unsuccessful one tries to deny that the mistakes exist.
You know, extremely smart people are sometimes quite arrogant because they believe in what they believe in, right? And so when they face criticism, it's less likely to admit, you know, they can make mistakes. Was that in your case?
I learned it when I was studying physics.
Mm-hmm.
In physics, you're taught to always question yourself. You're taught to always assume that you're wrong, not assume that you're right, and you have to prove yourself not wrong. And so I think that physics framework is really where I learned it, and it's very effective for learning counterintuitive things that aren't obvious.
Mm-hmm. So you are very famous in saying that failure is actually an option, and if you're not failing, that means you're not innovative enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I like failure. I mean, who likes failure? It's terrible. Yeah. But if you only do things that are certain to succeed, then you're only going to be doing very obvious things. When I interview someone to work at the companies, would be to ask them to tell me about the problems that they worked on and how they solved them. And if someone was really the person that solved it, they'll be able to answer multiple levels. They'll be able to go down to the brass tacks. And if they weren't, they'll get stuck. And then you can say, oh, this person was not really the person who solved it, because anyone who struggled hard with a problem never forgets.
If you're creating a company or if you're joining a company, the most important thing is to
is to attract great people. So either be with, join a group that's amazing that you really respect, or if you're building a company, you've got to gather great people. I mean, all a company is a group of people that have gathered together to create a product or service. And so depending upon how talented and hardworking that group is and the degree to which they are focused cohesively in a good direction, that will determine the success of the company. So do everything you can to gather great people if you're creating a company.
You've got to make sure that whatever you're doing is a great product or service. It has to be really great. And I go back to what I was saying earlier, where if you're a new company, I mean, unless it's like some new industry or new market that, if it's an untapped market, or then you have more ability to, the standard is lower for your product or service. But if you're entering anything where there's an existing marketplace against large entrenched competitors, then your product or service needs to be much better than theirs. It can't be a little bit better, because then you put yourself in the shoes of the consumer, and they say, why would you buy it as a consumer? You're always going to buy the trusted brand unless there's a big difference. So a lot of times, you know, entrepreneur will come up with something which is only slightly better. And it can't just be slightly better. It's got to be a lot better.
You are unusually fearless and willing to go in the face of other people telling you something is crazy. And I know a lot of pretty crazy people, you still stand out. Where does that come from, or how do you think about making a decision when everyone tells you this is a crazy idea? Or where do you get the internal strength to do that?
Well, first of all, I'd say I feel fear quite strongly. So it's not as though I just have the absence of fear. I feel it quite strongly. But there are just times when something is important enough, you believe in it enough, that you do it in spite of the fear.
So speaking of important things.
Like, people shouldn't think, people shouldn't think, well, I feel fear about this and therefore I shouldn't do it. It's normal to feel fear. Like, you'd have to, there'd be something mentally wrong if you didn't feel fear.
So you just feel it and let the importance of it drive you to do it anyway.
Yeah. Actually, something that can be helpful is fatalism to some degree. If you just accept the probabilities, then that diminishes fear. When starting SpaceX, I thought the odds of success were less than 10%. And I just accepted that actually probably I would just lose everything. But that maybe we would make some progress. If we could just move the ball forward, even if we died, maybe some other company could pick up the baton and move and keep moving it forward. So that would still do some good. Same with Tesla. I thought the odds of a car company succeeding were extremely low. Depending upon how well you want to do, and particularly if you're starting a company, you need to work super hard. So what does super hard mean? When my brother and I were starting our first company, instead of getting an apartment, we just rented a small office and we slept on the couch. And we showered at the YMCA, and we're so hard up, we had one computer. So the website was up during the day, and I was coding at night. 7 days a week, all the time. And I sort of briefly had a girlfriend in that period, and in order to be with me, she had to sleep in the office. So work hard, like, every waking hour. That's the thing I would say, particularly if you're starting a company. If you do simple math, say, like, okay, if somebody else is working 50 hours and you're working 100, you'll get twice as much done in the course of a year as the other company.
One does have to be focused on the short term and money coming in when creating a company, because otherwise the company will die. So I think that a lot of times people think like creating a company is going to be fun. I would say it's not. It's really not that fun. I mean, there are periods of fun, and there are periods of where it's just awful. And particularly if you're the CEO of the company. You actually have a distillation of all the worst problems in the company. There's no point in spending your time on things that are going right. So you only spend your time on things that are going wrong. And there are things that are going wrong that other people can't take care of. So you have like the worst. You have a filter for the crappiest problem in the company, the most pernicious and painful problem.
So I wouldn't say it's I think you have to feel quite compelled to do it and have a fairly high pain threshold. And there's a friend of mine who says, like, starting a company is like staring into the abyss and eating glass. And there's some truth to that. The staring into the abyss part is that you're going to be constantly facing the extermination of the company. Because most startups fail. It's like 90%, arguably 99% of startups fail. So that's the staring into the abyss part. You're constantly saying, okay, this, if I don't get this right, the company will die. It should be quite stressful. And then the eating glass part is you've got to do the problems. You've got to work on the problems that the company needs you to work on, not the problems you want to work on. And so that's you end up working on problems that you'd really wish you weren't working on. And so that's the eating glass part. And that goes on for a long time.
So how do you keep your focus on the big picture when you're constantly faced with, we could be out of business in a month?
Well, it's just a very small percentage of mental energy is on the big picture. Like, you know where you're generally heading for, and the actual path is going to be some sort of zigzaggy thing in that direction. And try not to deviate too far from the path that you want to be on, but you're going to have to do that to some degree. But I don't want to diminish the. I mean, I think the profit motive is a good one if the rules of an industry are properly set up. So there's nothing fundamentally wrong with profit. In fact, profit just means that people are paying you more for whatever you're doing than you're spending to create it. That's a good thing. and if that's not the case, then you'll be out of business, and rightfully so. Because you're not adding enough value.
Being innovative can be very exciting life, but doing business sometimes requires, you know, persistence, and sometimes could be very boring. Do you have the same fun from innovation as from business, running a business?
Would you rather be just
an innovator, engineer, instead of a business owner or runner?
I mean, I'd love to just do innovation and just do engineering. Yeah. But you raise a good point, because, you know, a lot of life in general, in any job, there's like, you have to do your chores. Mm-hmm. You know, there's...
Because nobody else can do that for you, right?
Well, to be successful at almost anything, you have to do the tough stuff and as well as the enjoyable stuff. You have to do the boring stuff as well as the non-boring stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do your chores, then bad things will happen. But if they don't do the things that they don't like to do, then the company will be in trouble.
Yeah.
Like, you have to, you basically, like, it's more fun to cook the meal than to clean the dishes. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you need to clean the dishes.
You need to do both.
Yes, you need to do both, exactly.
First of all, I really need to give some thought to, like, how can I provide advice that would be most helpful? And I'm not sure I've given enough thought to that to give you the best possible answer. But I think certainly being focused on something that you're confident will have high value to someone else, and just being really rigorous in making that assessment, mm-hmm. because people tend to a natural human tendency is wishful thinking. So a challenge for entrepreneurs is to say, well, what's the difference between really believing in your ideals and sticking to them versus pursuing some unrealistic dream that doesn't actually have merit? And that is a really difficult thing to tell. Can you tell the difference between those two things?
Right.
You know? So you need to be sort of very rigorous in your self-analysis. I think certainly extremely tenacious and then just work like hell. I mean, you just have to put in, you know, 80 to 100 hour weeks every week.
It's a lot of work.
All those things improve the odds of success.
Okay.
I mean, if other people are putting in 40-hour work weeks and you're putting in 100-hour work weeks, then even if you're doing the same thing, you know that in 1 year you will achieve what they achieve. You will achieve in 4 months what it takes them a year to achieve.
I would definitely advise people who are starting a company to expect a long period of quite high difficulty.
Yeah.
But I mean, as long as people stay super focused on creating the absolute best product or service that really delights their end customer, if they stay focused on that, then if you get it such that your customers want you to succeed, then you probably will.
All right. You have to focus on the customer and delivering for them.
Yeah. Make sure if your customers love you, your odds of success are dramatically higher. Yeah.
Question that has been discussed over the past couple of days. Should we be considering one-way-only trips to Mars? What's the best approach to colonize the planet? Is it... what's your view? Is that socially acceptable? Do you think people will sign up to do it?
I think there's plenty of people that will sign up for a one-way trip to Mars.
We could have a show of hands, who would consider such an option? Okay. I see some, not many, but perhaps enough for a couple of missions.
So it's certainly be enough. I mean, I think it's sort of like, is it a one-way mission and then you die? Or is it one-way mission and you get resupplied? That's a big difference.
Wait for the second option.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it ends up being a moot point because you want to bring the spaceship back. Like, these spaceships are expensive, okay? They're hard to build. You can't just leave them there. So whether or not people want to come back or not is kind of, like, they can jump on if they want, but they need the spaceship back.
Thank you.
I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, there's like a huge collection of spaceships on Mars over time. And like, it's like, maybe we should send them back. I mean, of course we should send them back.
CEO of SpaceX, and you've said that your ultimate goal is to get humankind to Mars. Mm-hmm. I've heard your response to the question, but these guys need to hear it. Why is Mars important? Why does Mars matter?
Sure. Well, I think it's really a fundamental decision we need to make as a civilization. What kind of future do we want? Do we want a future where we are forever confined to one planet until some eventual extinction event, however far in the future that might occur? Or do we want to become a multi-planet species and then ultimately be out there among the stars and be among many planets, many star systems? And I think the latter is a far more exciting and inspiring future than the former. And Mars is the next natural step. In fact, it's the only planet we really have a shot at establishing a self-sustaining city on. And I think once we do establish such a city, there will be a strong forcing function for the improvement of spaceflight technology that will then enable us to establish colonies elsewhere in the solar system and ultimately extend beyond our solar system. And so there's the defensive reason of protecting the future of humanity, ensuring that the light of consciousness is not extinguished should some calamity befall Earth. But also, and that's the defensive reason. But personally, I find gets me more excited is the fact that this would be an incredible adventure. Mm. I mean, it'd be like the greatest adventure ever. Mm. Mm. And it would be exciting and inspiring. And there need to be things that excite and inspire people.
Yeah.
You have to be, reasons why you get up in the morning. It can't just be solving problems. It's got to be, something great's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, we talked about this at length yesterday. It's not an exit strategy or a backup plan for humankind when Earth fails.
Right.
It's also to inspire people on Earth, right, and to transcend and to go beyond our mental limits of what we think we can achieve.
Right. I mean, you think of sort of how incredible the Apollo program was. And I mean, if you ask anyone and say, name some of humanity's greatest achievements of the 20th century, the Apollo program, landing on the moon, would in many, if not most places, be number one.
2001, with just talking to a friend of mine, and he asked me what I was going to do after PayPal, and I thought, well, I was wondering, I'd like to get involved in space, but I just didn't think there was anything I could do as an individual, but I was curious as to when we'd NASA would be sending a team to Mars, because that was always going to be the thing to do after the moon. I figured that there'd be some plan, and I'd just go to the website and I could read the schedule.
then Mars occurs.
Like, oh, yeah, it's like, okay, 2017, good, okay. But actually, there wasn't anything on the website, and or at least I thought, am I, can I not find it? Like, what's going on here?
And is it secret? I don't know. But it turned out that that NASA had done a study on what it would cost to send to do a manned Mars mission, and this was under Bush the First. And in his first, he asked for a 90-day study shortly after taking office, and NASA came back with a $500 billion price tag. And he said, okay, maybe not.
Billion with a B.
That's when $500 mm-hmm. billion dollars was serious money for the government. So then that got totally shelved, and it was like you were not allowed to talk about any kind of crewed mission to Mars at NASA. I thought, if I can do something that would galvanize public interest, and then that public interest would translate to additional appropriations for NASA and increase their budget, then maybe they could do it. So what I would do is send a small greenhouse to the surface of Mars with seeds and dehydrated gel, and then upon landing, hydrate the gel and grow the plants. And the public tends to respond to precedents and superlatives. So this would be the furthest that life's ever traveled, the first life on Mars. I tried to figure out how to do this with the proceeds that I had from PayPal. I was able to figure out how to get the cost of the spacecraft down and the communications and the little greenhouse and everything. But the one thing I couldn't compress was the cost of launch, because there are only a few options. And the U.S. options were way too expensive. So I ended up going to Russia 3 times to try to buy the biggest ICBM in the Russian nuclear fleet.
That's where I'd start, yeah.
Yeah.
Go big or go home, right?
Yeah. I mean, okay. You know, there were some strange trips, that's for sure. But you know, it's like virtually, like you can buy any, it's a very capitalist society in some ways. So I actually did negotiate a deal to buy 2 of the ICBMs minus the nukes. But I came to the conclusion after that third trip that it wouldn't really matter. Like I actually came to the conclusion that my initial premise was wrong. Because I actually think there's a tremendous amount of will in the American population, particularly to explore. The United States, you know, maybe more than any other country, is a distillation of the human spirit of exploration. And it's really fundamental to psyche. So if people think there's a way, I think it would actually get a lot of support. Mm-hmm. But it can't be just banging your head against the wall. You've got to believe that this can be done without breaking the federal budget. That's when I said, okay, well, is there some way to affect the cost of space transport? I got together with a group of people over a series of Saturdays just to try to understand, is there something fundamentally super expensive about rockets, or can the cost be substantially improved? We had a bunch of those kind of brainstorming sessions, and I couldn't see any fundamental obstacle to improving the cost of rockets, so that's when I started SpaceX.
It's like, I'll just build them myself.
But like I said, at that point, I would say the probability of success was definitely less than 50%. I thought it would most likely not succeed. But it was worth a try.